The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. I'm Nick McCarville, and we are settling into our courtside groove here on episode 6. We've got a couple great interviews. First off, it's Katrina Adams. She's the chairman of the board as well as the president for the USTA, serving in an unprecedented second term, and I got the chance to speak with her courtside a couple weeks ago in Indian Wells. We found a nice spot in an empty stadium and had a pretty candid chat about everything from the Williams sisters to the up-and-coming Americans to the initiatives that she is trying to help promote and push at the USTA. And then Steve Flink, a Hall of Famer himself, speaks with another Hall of Famer in Tony Trabert. Tony Trabert was a Grand Slam winning tennis player in the 1950s. He had one of the best tennis seasons of all time in 1955, and he also continued his career as Davis Cup captain, as a commentator, and the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame from 2001 to 2011. Steve has an incredibly insightful chat with Tony Trabert. That's in the second part of episode 6, but first, let's get to my chat with Katrina Adams. Katrina Adams, first of all, how's life? How's life in general? You're on the road a lot, right?
I love traveling. Life is good, it's busy, but I'm meeting so many fun people, going to a lot of fun venues, and I can't complain.
Yeah, so now March is a special time in U.S. for tennis, and we used to have a lot of more professional tennis in the States, but we're actually taping this in Indian Wells. We're sitting just off court 3, stadium 3, and I think when people listen to this, it's going to be time for Miami. What's special about sort of spring tennis in the U.S. to you?
Well, I think for us, for spring tennis, is really about, it's a time of year where you've got your parents trying to get their kids signed up for spring and summer activities, so it's a kickoff month. For us, we like to promote a lot of different things here in the U.S. And then you have the two major events with Indian Wells, Miami, back to back with all the professionals. A lot of opportunities for our young professionals to actually get out and have an opportunity to compete amongst the best in the world.
And then, what do you think? I mean, just for fans, it's kind of a special time too, because I know that for you guys at the USTA, the U.S. Open, the push for the series is big. But this is a great few weeks for U.S. tennis, just in general, to have it on the broadcast, to have all these young Americans playing, and we can feel the buzz here in Indian Wells, and I think there's a similar buzz around in Miami too.
Well, when you look at these events, and tennis is on 24/7 pretty much between ESPN and Tennis Channel, there's an opportunity for people to get excited about springtime, about the warm weather, and to really get back out on the court. So that's what we look forward to this time of year. But again, we've got a lot of young players that have an opportunity to play in the qualifying of these events or get wild cards and really get the taste of the big league, if you will.
Can you detail for me, just, you know, we'll switch gears here to talk about the U.S. Open in a minute, but what's kept you busy recently? Because we talk a little bit about your travel. We're here in Indian Wells. People listen to this during Miami, but for you and the projects that you're trying to push and the things that you guys are trying to do, what are a few of the things that you've been very excited about that you've been sort of trying to get out there and continue to grow the sport in the States?
Well, right now it's a big push for our new youth brand, Net Generation, and we'll be full bloom in May. And so it's about getting our providers, all of our coaches, our clubs, everyone that's providing tennis to sign up for it, to make sure that they go through the process of understanding what it means. It's a brand, it's not a program. So we want our clubs, we want our parks, we want our kids, we want our parents, everybody to be engaged and be a part of Net Generation. It's a rock and roll type of image and feel for the kids to get them excited and energized about, if they're not already in the sport, to get into the sport. And those that are already playing, they'll have an opportunity to say, hey, I'm a Net Genner, or I'm a part of the Net Generation. So anybody from California can be connected to somebody in Washington, D.C. And be a part of the same movement, if you will. So we're really excited about that. It's about really the time of the year. A lot of our tournaments are getting going again. A lot of our adult tournaments and our leagues are getting up and running. So we want to make sure that they have an opportunity to also get excited and get back on the court and compete.
Gosh, I love how you talk about that too, because I think in professional tennis terms, you know, my job is a lot of following the tour, but it also, spring is the time when people listening and people all over the country start to play tennis again, which is exciting.
Hey, warm weather brings you outside. You know, we got a lot of people across this country that don't really have access to indoor facilities. And so they rely on the public parks and the high school courts, etc. And so once the weather starts to break, although we've been having nor'easters.
We've been having quite the winter.
And rain and snow all across the country. It's been difficult for the last month. So
yeah.
Hopefully, you know, turning on the television and watching Indian Wells is getting people inspired and invigorated to want to get back out there.
Okay, so recently Steve Flink and I spoke a little bit about Althea Gibson being honored at the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center with the statue. We're not sure if it's going to happen this year, but you guys announced that that's happening. Just what's so special about honoring Althea? I mean, she is such a force, a name in the sport, and what she was able to do for it. But I just think it's so cool that's finally happening at the USTA.
Well, Billie Jean said it best. She is the Jackie Robinson of tennis. She truly broke the color barrier in professional tennis and playing at Wimbledon and the U.S. Nationals then before it was the U.S. Open. But, you know, she's won the French Open, Finals of Australia. You know, people don't realize just how powerful and how much of a force she was on the tour, but also what she had to endure to just have an opportunity to go out and compete. She fared better outside of the U.S., whereas in the U.S., many facilities that she played at, she still couldn't go to the locker room or the same bathroom or drink out of the same fountain. So what she endured to become a champion is astounding, and it's amazing. And she and Arthur had the same coach. So Arthur came behind Althea Gibson.
Yeah.
She won it in 1957-58. He won it in 1968. And so to understand that if it wasn't for Althea taking the brunt of the racial injustice that she had to experience, he may not have had the opportunity to get to where he got.
Yeah, which is incredible, because we're celebrating this year the 50 years of open era tennis, the 50th U.S. Open. But she played, did she play all of her career, I think, before the, you know, or majority of her career before the open era, which you're saying, I mean, it was even more difficult to try to break those barriers at that point, too.
Well, more difficult and more challenging, too, because the money was not there. I mean, it still wasn't there for the women in 1968 compared to what the men had. But, you know, it's amazing what she was able to accomplish and to keep her dignity and to be the champion that she was. And she went from tennis to golf. She was a singer. People don't know that she actually has an album out, musical album.
I have no idea.
She's very talented. and someone that obviously, me being an African-American woman, I've idolized and really looked up to and had a chance to meet and you know, and also went to her funeral to pay my respects. So it's I'm really excited that we are finally getting something on the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center to recognize her. It's something that I've wanted for a very long time. It's something that when I took office, I had in the back of my mind that I wanted to get accomplished. You know, I got a nudge from Billie Jean King last year, and we got it done with our board of directors in December.
Yeah, well, so that is a statue of Althea Gibson. We're not sure when it's gonna come, but hopefully soon.
We would love to have it for this year's Open, but again, you know, we just, approved it in December, and you want to do it right. You want to get the right artist.
Yeah.
You want to go through the renderings, and but at least hopefully we'll have something, maybe a picture of what it will look like.
Yeah.
To unveil at the 2018 U.S.
Open,
and then hopefully by 2019 we'll have it on the grounds.
Okay, so while we're on the topic of Althea Gibson and sitting with you here as a African American woman, we're recording this the night before Venus and Serena are set to play in Indian Wells, and it just, because Serena's comeback itself has been incredible.
Right.
I mean, just the two matches that we've seen her play. But, you know, talk in general terms for you about what those two have done for the sport, because it's hard for us to, I think, realize how lucky we are right now in this moment. But they have helped further this sport, I think, through the roof the last two decades.
No, absolutely. Listen, I played against them. So I watched them grow up. I played against them. I was at the first match in 1994 when Venus played her first professional tournament out in
Oakland.
Oakland.
Yeah.
And you knew they were going to be a reckoning force, but you didn't really understand what that meant. You know, Richard said from the beginning that he was going to have the number one and two player in the world at the same time, and they were both going to be number one, and doggone it, they did that. So when you see their progression and how they did it and what they're able to accomplish, they sparked a whole new generation of players.
Yeah.
And it's evident when you look at the 2017 U.S. Open finalists with Sloane Stephens and Madison Keys, and both of them saying that they had one or the other poster on their wall growing up. That says a lot. So they've inspired, you know, thousands if not millions of young players around the country and around the world. But not only have they done that in tennis, but it's what they've done off the court to inspire and to lead by example in business and in Serena opening her schools in Africa. It's mm-hmm. it's just amazing. And so to have seen them play here 20 years ago and not play for 20 years or 15, I forget how many years it was, and to come back last year to play, and then now to actually play each other.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, it's kind of full circle.
Yeah, you know, it is.
Life is a full circle, I like to say. And I'm actually here. I'll be here. I'm excited that I'm actually here to watch that match.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
You know, for a long time in tennis, I think it was in your early 30s. There was some sort of reckoning moment for a lot of players that they needed to step away. Not everyone, but most players, especially the women, and maybe you yourself included. But they have flipped that script. And I guess I don't know. I'm still at a loss to sort of, I think because we're consuming it right now, it's so great. But Serena this week in Indian Wells has talked about how she just wants to play. And maybe one day she'll wake up and say, I don't want to work this hard anymore. But gosh, they're 36 and they're 37 and they're still doing it.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was one of those that you're so used to being at. Back then, when you turned 30, you were called a grandma on tour. And so you set these goals to retire. And my goal was to retire at 30. I was 31. But, you know, Venus is saying she's going to play the 2020 Olympics. She'll be 40 then. So they have rewritten the script in every way imaginable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful to witness.
Okay, well, one thing I'm very excited about is new Louis. This year they've been working hard in Flushing, but not only do we have a new stadium, obviously with a roof at the U.S. Open, but we also have night sessions. You guys announcing that you're going to have night sessions at Louis Armstrong. I guess just overall the experience, what are you excited about for new Louis?
Well, you know, it's a new state-of-the-art stadium. We're going to have a roof on it. Hopefully we won't have to use it, but if we have to, we have it at our disposal. It'll be 14,000 seats, and it's really going to be spectacular. And I think when you look at the U.S. Open, the U.S. Open really is known for their night sessions. And we've always had night matches on Louis, not before 7 o'clock.
Sure.
We've had matches that go over on there till midnight. But I think by actually offering two different sessions just brings more excitement and more energy to the stadium. But it'll also bring more high-level matches to Louis Armstrong that may normally be on Arthur Ashe Stadium.
And when you look at, you know, you're talking about the night session, I think every player I've ever talked to is like, oh, the U.S. Open is night tennis to me. But overall, sort of, what are you most excited about that new Louis? Because it really is going to be a world-class, at least from what I understand, it's going to be a pretty awesome facility for us to play tennis in.
It's going to be intimate. It's going to be innovative. You know, when we built the Grandstand Stadium, couple years ago, people thought that was like the best thing next to sliced bread. But I think when they walk into Louis Armstrong this year, they're just going to have that feeling like, wow, this is it.
Yeah, awesome. What? Just talking about the U.S. Open for a second, 50 years, open era tennis. I guess what does it mean to celebrate this part of tennis history this year? And sort of what gets, you know, when you look back, because I know that you've been involved in so many different ways, what do you sort of get tickled by in being a part of the sport in such a big way?
Well, I mean, this is the greatest year ever because I was born 50 years ago. So
should I be wishing you a happy birthday?
It'll be right before the Open.
Okay.
But it's anytime you can celebrate anything for 50 years, it shows that there's stamina, there's longevity, and there's credibility. And that's the one thing that our sport has had, and open tennis as a whole. So in celebrating the U.S. Open 50th anniversary, you know, we've accomplished so much over the years. We've grown so much over the years. We have been, you know, more and more innovative every year. And when you look at our first champion 50 years ago with Arthur Ashe and Virginia Wade, and we get to see who will be the champion in 2018, tennis has been remarkable at the U.S. Open. So I'm excited to see who will be that 50th champion on the men and women's side.
Yes.
You know, the 49 champions were pretty amazing with Rafa,
yeah,
and Sloan Stephens.
Right.
And it's going to be a thrill.
Can I ask you a favorite U.S. Open memory? I mean, you played it a few times, too.
My personal, as a player, you know what? It's funny. It was the worst tournament for me. It was,
was
one
it?
Of those that I just could not. I felt the pressure. I felt the pressure of being at home on my home soil, of my family, my friends, my fans that were there. You know, I never got past the third round of singles and quarters of doubles. So I really don't have fond memories of my own
okay.
performances.
I've dredged up bad memories here.
Yeah, no, it's all good. But, you know, I mean, watching many of the first night match for women's tennis, you know, in prime time with Venus and Serena, I think is probably one that I'll never forget because it was where the women were being showcased. And not only were they being showcased, the finals was Venus and Serena. So for me, that was like, wow. That was that wow moment for me. There's been many since then, but I would say that in the course of my career, because I was still on tour, that was pretty exciting.
Okay, now people cannot see the new U.S. Open logo on this podcast, but I think they'll have seen it somewhere on the internet. Just dropped a few days ago. I like it. It's futuristic. It's different. It's not too different, though. Why switch up the logo at this point for the U.S. Open?
Well, I think it's, again, it's our 50th anniversary. So you want to make sure that you're doing something that's clean, that's fast forward, that's innovative, that stands out. And that can last another 50 years. You know, our last logo, I think we changed it in 2000 or 1999.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we think it's time. It's time to make sure that we are like the rest of the world and being innovative.
Yeah, well, I think everyone out there appreciates that. And I also, I just want to appreciate for a minute, we're standing again in Indian Wells, but a lot of folks will listen to this during Miami. And just, I think the specialness of not only pro tennis, but just tennis as a game in the U.S. and the sport, it continues, I think, to capture a lot of imaginations and to motivate a lot of people, whether they're just sitting on their couch and watching or getting up and playing every day themselves.
Well, I think this venue in particular is pretty special with what Larry Ellison and his crew has done out here at Indian Wells with, you know, multiple stadiums, two main stadiums here are really spectacular and great dining. And they've created some shaded areas, which is important in Indian Wells out here in the desert. But again, it's where we really kickstart tennis for the spring. A lot of kids coming out here on the weekend from Southern Cal area. They're getting inspired, you know, have opportunity to watch the big players practice. We go from here, we go to the other coast, you know, Miami, in the same atmosphere, same opportunity for a lot of people to get up close and personal to the players. And you can watch it pretty much 24/7 for, you know, for the next 4 weeks from here and through Miami.
Yeah.
And
right.
So everyone's getting energized and ready to get off the couch, shed the scarves and the hats and the gloves and get out there and start playing tennis.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. And we're wishing the U.S. Open a happy 50th. And I guess to you, too, come August.
Thank you. We're really excited. Appreciate it.
Okay. So we're all going to have to mark our calendars for August for Katrina's birthday and for the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open. Let's now get to Tony Trabert. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, this is a great chat between him and our own Steve Flink. What I really find interesting is Tony going into detail about taking road trips with his fellow competitors, about the prize money differentiation between then and now, and then he really goes from the 1950s all the way up to today, talking not only about the U.S. Open, but about his truly storied career as a player, coach, commentator, and the many other hats that he wore, including the U.S. Open trophy presentation host which was not an easy job. Here's Tony Trabert with Steve Flink.
We're very happy to have on the podcast this week Tony Trabert, one of the most multifaceted and prodigious achievers in the history of tennis, certainly in American tennis. And Tony, thanks so much for agreeing to join us today.
Well, you're welcome, Steve. It's my pleasure.
Now, Tony, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Open and, of course, of the Open era itself, which started in April 22, 1968. What were your feelings at that point when the Open era started and you're in your late 30s? And was there any remorse, Tony, for you that you missed out on playing in the Open era yourself?
No, not remorse for sure. I was would like to have been in my prime at that stage. We had worked for years as pros, pioneering, traveling over the world, trying to sell tennis and work for Open Tennis. And I was just thrilled to death that it finally got to a point where you had amateurs and pros playing in the same event, because people were saying, well, who are better, the amateurs or the pros? And we said, well, let's put them together and find out. And that finally happened.
What are your recollections of that first U.S. Open itself, Tony? I don't know, were you there on site at Forest Hills, or were you following it from afar? What are your impressions as you look back on that historic tournament?
Actually, I was there. Dick Savitt and I played doubles together just so that we could say we played in the first Open in the States.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah, how'd you do?
We beat some twins from Indonesia or something. We lost, I can't remember, too, to be honest with you. I had not played that much in the previous year or two, and Dick is older than I, so we weren't favored to win by any means, but we did participate.
Let's talk a little bit about your career, which was outstanding, especially in the 1950s, you know, winning your five majors in singles and five more in doubles. And let's focus first on the two at Forest Hills in 53 and 55. What are your recollections of those? Because, of course, you beat your great friend Vic Satius in one final and Kenny Rosewall in another. What are your foremost memories of those title runs that you enjoyed?
Well, I was in the Navy during the Korean War from September of 51 till June of 53, and I spent 16 months on an aircraft carrier out in the Atlantic and Mediterranean. So I finished down at Coronado down near San Diego and was able to practice some, and I started working to become more fit and started playing tournaments, and my target was Forest Hills. So I did win some tournaments en route that summer and was getting more fit and, you know, getting rid of the rust, and got to Forest Hills and just luckily hit it just right. I didn't lose a set, and I beat Rosewall in the semis, and I beat Vic, who was the reigning Wimbledon champion, like 3-2 and 3 in final. You know, it was a big thrill, of course, to win our own championship.
Absolutely. Now, of course, that was the first time around. And 55 was your greatest year, Tony, and you won 106 out of 113 matches and 18 of 23 tournaments. One of the great years any tennis champion has ever celebrated. So you come to Forest Hills then, and would you say that one was maybe even more comprehensive on your part, where you destroyed Lou Hode and beat Rosewall solidly? Looking at the scores, not having been there, It seems to me, as an historian, that maybe that was the best major of your career?
Certainly by name it was, in terms of the people I beat. But to be fair, we had played Davis Cup the weekend before at Forest Hills. In 1954, Vic and I regained the Davis Cup from the Australians, Hode and Rosewall. We played the challenge round the weekend before the U.S. Championships in 55, and they beat us. They grabbed the cup back. And, you know, after you play in a major event like that, it's pretty hard to get fired up right afterwards. And I played Lou Hode in the semifinals, and he didn't play his best, and I beat him straight sets. Again, I didn't lose a set during the tournament. And then I played Kenny in the finals and beat him in straight sets. By name, I mean, the names of those players, it was a big event for me. I was obviously thrilled, you know, having followed the French in Wimbledon. It's interesting, Steve, that it's fact, so I'm not bragging about it, but I won Wimbledon and the U.S. twice without losing a set. So I was able to get to a pretty high quality and hold it for 2 weeks. Lou Hode was more talented than I, but he had peaks and valleys, and if he got above my line, he beat me. If he got below it, I got him, sort of thing. So I caught him blow up in that semifinal match.
Absolutely. But Rosewell, of course, we think of him as, you know, with the immaculate ground strokes and such a solid player. It, you had to beat him, so you must have felt that was a different cup of tea from playing Lou Hode, was it not?
Yes. Yeah, they're, you know, everybody's different. Their styles are different. You got to play them differently. I had beaten Rosewell in Davis Cup a couple of years, so I was fairly confident, you know, against him. Hode, depending on, like I say, how well he played, could be a very, very difficult guy to beat. On the other hand, sometimes when he didn't play his best, it wasn't so tough.
What do you think it was, though, about that year? I mean, must have been the pinnacle of your career to be that dominant, and you're being modest about what happened at Forest Hills, but that whole year you were virtually invincible, and the only loss you had at a major was to Rosewall at the Australian. How disappointing was it that you couldn't? It seems as if you were capable of winning the Grand Slam that year.
To be honest, I'd never even thought about winning the Grand Slam when I started in Australia that year in '55, right after we had regained the cup and lost to Rosewall in the semis. You know, Steve, every tournament I entered, I wanted to win. I had to plan to win, and I had a good year when winning the French for the second time, beat Sten Davidson in the finals in four sets. In '55, and he won it a couple years later, and then Wimbledon, I beat Drabi in the quarters. He was a reigning champion at Wimbledon. I beat Budge Patty in the semis, and he had won it in 1950. We were playing in '55, and I played Curtin Nielsen in the finals, who upset Rosewall for the second time in 3 years to get to the finals, unseeded both times. And Vic beat him in '53, and I beat him in '55. So then it was on to Forest Hills, and I knew I was a good player. I was never cocky. I was never overly confident. My motto was, you're not safe till you're in a locker room. You know, I've seen too many people get ahead and let up and get beat. It's just, I tried as hard as I could all the time, and it worked out well. I had a fun year.
So it wasn't the kind of thing where after winning Forest Hills, you'd look back and wish that you could have somehow beaten Kenny in Australia and perhaps have gone on to win the Slam. It was more celebrating what was a pretty fantastic year for you.
Well, I was taught you can't worry about things you have no control over. Once I had lost to Rosewall, that's history. Can't do anything about it. You got to keep moving forward, you know. So, sure, I would love to win the Grand Slam and have high regard for Laver and Budge and for Maureen Connolly and Margaret Court and Steffi Graf, the only players that won the Grand Slam. It had been terrific to be named with those stars, but I'm not.
Now, Tony, then you went out into pro tennis and obviously toured with Gonzalez and then played the major pro events for up into the early 60s. What recap that experience a little bit about, first of all, what it was like to play somebody as ferocious as Gonzalez night after night in difficult conditions indoors, and what the life was like compared to the more glamorous settings you'd been used to as an amateur playing at the majors.
Well, it did take some adjustment because we were driving most of the time. We flew some in the States, but most of the time we were driving from city to city. And, you might play in L.A. one night and play in San Francisco the next night. And you had to drive there and get some rest when you could and eat when you could. And we played on a canvas court held down with block and tackle. You know, would slip and slide a little bit. The court would move a little bit as you pushed off. And so often we were in a high school gym or something where the lighting wasn't very good, or the background wasn't very good, or the ceiling was low. And so they were difficult conditions. Gonzalez had a big serve. He beat me 74-27. We had a lot of close matches. You finally get used to it, the grind, if you will. Sometimes we played in front of 200 people. Sometimes we played in front of a couple thousand people. We just never knew. Ponce Segura was not a good driver. We didn't let him drive, so he would take a nap and sleep and then beat your brains out that night in a dark gymnasium somewhere, you know. I remember we were going from Arkansas to Oklahoma City. We'd take turns driving. We were in two different station wagons. The tour manager, Olin Parks, and Rex Hartwig and I were in one, and the two Ponches were in the other. And we stopped about 100 miles from Oklahoma City to a motel, and everything was full. There was some convention, so we had to keep going. And I was driving, and like 4 in the morning, and was going like 100, and fell asleep at the wheel. And when we started off the highway and, you know, hit that gravel, the noise woke me up and I was able to straighten it out, and we were fortunate not to, you know, not to have an accident. And we came up to a little restaurant shortly thereafter, and we stopped and drank a bunch of coffee, you know, to keep on going. But those are the types of things that we had to do. You'd stop and get gas, and there'd be a diner next to the gas station, and you go in there and get a bowl of soup or some eggs, something that I knew that, you know, wouldn't make you sick, and gobble it down and keep on going. We were just troopers, you know, had to be there. And a couple of times we got in Canada, they had trouble getting the truck through with the court, so we helped the guy put the court down, and the people got there before we got the court secured, and they enjoyed watching the mechanics of putting the court down. So those type of experiences were always interesting, and I have fond memories of the whole thing.
Tony, obviously you had to make a choice there at the end of 55, having dominated amateur tennis the way you did. How difficult a decision, or how easy a decision was it to say, I'm going pro, I'm going to play against Gonzalez, it's time to make that move?
Well, I was married, and you know, and we were going to have a family, and I had to make some money. Jack Kramer offered me a guarantee against a percentage. The plan was that Hode and Rosewall were going to turn pro, which they actually signed contracts with Jack. And Kramer and I were going to play Hode and Rosewall on the tour. And we would play Australia-America, switched opponents each night. I'd play Hode one night, Rosewall the next, and vice versa. And then when Hode and Rosewall got back to Australia, they got talked out of it. And Jack Kramer let them out from under their contracts. And he said to me, if you went out, I'll let you out too. And I said, no, I've signed, I'm committed, and let's go. So they brought Gonzalez in. I played 14 straight months, averaged about five matches a week on five continents, and made about $125,000. You know, everybody says, yeah, but when bread was a nickel and gas was a dime. And I said, you can give me Federer's $20 million this year, and he can have my $150 back then, you know. But again, it's something that I don't worry about and don't fret over, because I have no control over it. You know, you weren't getting rich playing as amateur tennis, contrary to what a lot of people think. So it was my choice to move on. I, having had such a good year, the time was ripe. I have no regrets at having done that. Later, I worked for Jack Kramer. I moved to Paris for 3 years with my family and helped run pro tennis in Europe and Australia, and I mean in Asia and Africa. I signed some other players from different countries, trying to weaken their Davis Cup team so that the countries of officials would say, hey, we better let our guys go and let's let him go play pro tennis. I signed Rod Laver to a contract in 1963. He couldn't play a course in any of the Grand Slam events until 68.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thinking, were you thinking that open tennis, you could force it to come about sooner? What during those years in Paris, did you think it might happen?
We didn't know when. We just thought it had to come. And when you had so many good players that weren't playing at Wimbledon, and Wimbledon were calling themselves the World Championships, and they were the ones that finally said, we're going to do it, and they did it. And from then on, it was off the game flew.
Tony, now, once open tennis started, you had a number of very prominent roles. You were outstanding commentator for CBS from the early 70s up to 2004, and Davis Cup captain at the second half of the 70s, and had a couple of victorious teams. And then you went on to become the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame for 10 years from 01 to 11. Let's talk about what you did in those capacities, starting with the commentary, because many people I know believe that you were really the best in the business, certainly as an analyst, and clearly conveying what was going on in the court, being fair to both players, analyzing it so astutely. Talk about the enjoyment you got out of that role, and also of particularly working out at the Open so many years as a top-notch announcer.
Well, thank you for those compliments. I love doing the broadcasting. It was fun. It was fun preparing. I had 10 times the number of notes in front that I ever used in any telecast. My job was to point out to the viewer, the person watching from home, what they didn't see. And what I mean by that is I've watched football forever, and I'd see a big hole open up the line, but I didn't know how that happened until they showed the replay. And so when you have a tennis broadcaster say, oh, that's a good backhand passing shot down the line, when I'm watching television, I know it went down the line. But I explain how that happened, what might have happened, what tactics might be. And I just enjoyed doing that and analyzing the game and the players. The more I did it, the more comfortable I got. I worked with some great people, with Brent Musburger and Pat Summerall and Jim Nance, and you know, it was a great experience. Enabled me to stay involved in the game. I also did 23 years for an Australian network, Channel 9, working with Fred Astaire and John Newcomb most of that time.
Right, and you worked with John Newcomb at the Open for a while in addition.
We did, indeed. Yeah. It was a wonderful experience from my standpoint. It, again, enabled me to stay involved and make a decent living and see some terrific tennis. So I watched all the players come through and marveled at how well they played and how the game changed with the equipment change and the prize money changes and everything else. So it's been fun watching. I enjoyed it.
Tony, what are your memories about the different sites? You know, obviously you started off early in that Open era in the 70s there, calling some at Forest Hills, and then you made the move to Flushing Meadows, and the complexion of the tournament changed, the surface changed, the entire atmosphere was altered. What are your memories of that from your standpoint as a commentator?
Forest Hills is unique, and we were sitting on an outside platform in a corner of the stadium. And I remember information. We didn't have a very good media guide in those days. We didn't know too much about the players. We were not supplied with much information about them as it happened later. I remember we ran out of matches one time at CBS on the center court, and they put a couple players out there, and one of the players was a big guy, lefty from Holland, Michigan, and had a big foot, and we sent a runner down to the press to see if we could get more information, and they didn't have anything else. So Pat Sermar talking about, boy, he'd be a good tight end. Looks like he wears a size 13 shoe, and he's left-handed. You know, and that's about all we had to wing it from then on, you know. And then the night shows we did from 11:15 to 11:30 in those days. We did it in a little shack outside the courts. Had to turn the air conditioning unit off. Could have made too much noise when we would perform, you know, and then turn it back on. And then when we'd record again, we'd turn it back off. And it was sort of rustic in those days. And obviously, it's, the whole thing changed there. And they've done a fabulous job, as have the French. All of them, actually. Australia's been terrific. And Wimbledon will always be Wimbledon. It was just a great experience and something I cherish.
Tony, when they did move the U.S. Open to Flushing Meadows, obviously you did a really nice job recalling the cramped conditions, you might say, at Forest Hills. You know, how did that change? How did things change for you once you got over to the new facility? And what were your feelings about this new era, hard courts, much bigger stadium, different types of crowds? What are your memories of that as the tournament went through this transformation?
Well, first of all, you know, we just outgrew Forest Hills. The tournament outgrew it. There weren't the facilities, not the parking facilities, the clubhouse. The stadium wasn't big enough. And so they went to Flushing Meadow, and, you know, and Louis Armstrong was a wonderful stadium playing because the fans were so close to the court. You know, they were right in the action. It changed tremendously. I thought the hard court's a fair thing because it's a good bounce, a good footing. You can count on the ball bouncing the same way each time it was hit the same way. And that made for better tennis. And so it was certainly a move in the right direction. And finally getting a roof over the center court was absolutely imperative.
Tony, going back to the Forest Hills era for a moment and thinking back to those U.S. Opens in the 70s, did you have the feeling that it was on its way to, from moving beyond just being a tennis event to something much bigger than that, a major sporting event in New York as it prepared to move on to Flushing Meadows?
As they enlarged things and added more courts and more grandstands and so forth, and obviously all the restaurants and shops, and it was like a little city. Night tennis there was always different. Crowds were more rowdy. They, you know, some had a few drinks and so forth, and so it was more noise and more enthusiasm. But obviously growing and growing, and the other majors recognized that they had to do the same thing, and so they all enlarged and improved things. And I never thought the game would get as big as it is, to be honest with you. I never thought that prize money would get to be what it is today, but I'm happy for the players.
Tony, one of the roles you had that I think you're always most remembered for was at the presentation ceremonies across the years, you know, greeting the winners and the runners-up, which is always a tricky thing to do. I'd like to get some of your recollections on that. Particularly, I know that you really cherish that moment of Graf winning the Grand Slam, and that you have a picture of that in your home, because that was certainly a special moment for you. Can you talk about that one, Steffi in 88, completing the Grand Slam, and any other, and what it was like to go down there and under delicate circumstances to deal with the winner the very euphoric winner and then the disappointed runner-up, and to get through that presentation ceremony and do both players justice?
Well, the Steffi Grand Slam was special, and it's true that I got four pictures, 8x10s, with me in it at the presentation with Steffi, not just the two of us posing, but, you know, taken as I was doing my job. I had those framed at home, and I talked to Andre Agassi, who married Steffi, later, and told him about them. I said, would you like to have them? And he said, I would. So I mailed it, shipped it out to them. So they actually have that. Going down to do the interviews was always difficult, particularly to speak to the one that lost. Well, you know, what do you say to him? It was easy for the one you won, you know, the person you could say, hey, you've got a bone sticking out of your leg. He said, yeah, but I sure served well, you know. The loser, I had to go carefully and try to say some things that were comforting and nice that I could. I remember one year when Arantxa Sánchez Vicario beat Steffi in the finals.
94.
Steffi won the first set and I think was winning in the second, and obviously hurt her back, and Sánchez beat her in three sets. And I was interviewing Steffi afterwards, and I got to a point where I said, midway through the second set, you know, you obviously hurt your back, and everybody in the stands started booing. And so Steffi was smart enough to say, I'm not going to go down that road. You know, no, I don't want to talk about it. I felt badly because I was being criticized. And when I came off the court, some of the reporters, Mike Lupica being one of them, said, hey, that's the first question I would ask. But those are the kinds of things you deal with. I'd be standing there waiting to start the presentation and waiting for commercials to be run and so forth. And we're all in position. And the spectator said, come on, Tony, let's go. Let's go, like I'm running the shop, you know. And said they say go finally, and off we went. It was interesting. It was fun. And one other thing, when I would be in the booth, and when it'd get near the end of the match, we thought it'd be near the end of the match, I would leave the booth and go down and get in the walkway where the players come in and out off the center court, standing there waiting to be able to go on the court when the match was over. One year, some player said to me, hey, I don't like to see you stand there because I figured I'm behind and you figured I've lost. So I stayed in an office right off the edge of where the players would wait to come out on the court so that I was out of sight for the players until it ended, and I was watching on a monitor. So there are all kinds of little things like that, you know, are fun and interesting. I didn't want the loser to feel any worse, and I know that the winner gets all the accolades and all the credit and so forth, so I just tried to tread lightly and, you know, be fair to both players.
You did that very, very well, Tony. In addition, the other leadership role that I segue over to, of course, was the Davis Cup captaincy. And you had some rather powerful personalities through the years during that captaincy. McEnroe through almost the entire tenure, Connors sporadically, Stan Smith, Arthur Ashe late in their careers. What did you like most about representing your country in that capacity, having played and won the Davis Cup as a player?
Well, anytime you can represent your country, it's a thrill and an honor from my standpoint, whether it's in military uniform or a Davis Cup. John McEnroe played his first Davis Cup match when I was captain. He played in the doubles in Chile, and then we played Great Britain in the finals that year out in Palm Springs, and he played singles. And he played every match every year that I was captain. He was the most coachable player I had, and that surprises most people when you say that because they think of his behavior. I could not get complete control of his behavior on the court, but he would come to the meetings, he would practice when he wanted to practice, he would stand up for the national anthem and do all the things that were expected of him, and the best part is he was always available to play. We went down to Argentina a couple of years and lost to Vilas and Clerc. John played his heart out, and we just didn't have enough good players to win down there in the clay. It's a thrill to win it twice, so I must say it was a bigger thrill for me to win it as a player than it was as captain. But to have people like John and Vitas Gerulaitis and Smith and Lutz and Harold Solomon and, you know, we had all kinds of people play for us. Brian Gottfried played, and so it was a thrill to play, and every time they'd play your national anthem, and it was just an honor.
Now, Tony, you had a great tenure there as captain, and you eventually moved on to the presidency of the Hall of Fame, which was a very critical role for you for 10 years, and you seemed ideally suited to it with your stature and stability, and sort of one of the game's great ambassadors. What was most rewarding to you about that role?
When they offered it to me, I said, "Hey, you got to tell me what's entailed got to give me some detail because I'm not going to accept it if I don't think I can handle it. If I can't do it justice, I don't want to get involved. I was a vice president at that time, you know, not nearly as active as the president would be. So they put some information together for me, and I was convinced that I could do it. They knew that because I didn't live in New York, I wasn't going to be the major fundraiser, but we had people on our board that could do that. But it was an absolute thrill, you know, to think of the history of the sport. Head of the nominating committee, so we decide who would go on the ballot each year. We had a meeting at Wimbledon every year. Had a terrific panel of 21 people from all over the world. It was just a thrill to see the sport grow and to know that we were protecting history and helping young people. We helped a couple veterans financially who never did turn pro and needed some money. You know, we did some of those things quietly. It was just an honor. I wish physically I could have continued doing it for a year or two longer. It just got worse. It was too difficult for me, and I had to step down.
Now, Tony, you've seen that. You've watched the U.S. Open, obviously, all those years working out there, but even since then, I know you've followed it. You've seen it grow by leaps and bounds, and here it is now, the big 50th anniversary year. How do you look at the evolution of the game and of the Open in this period of time and how it did evolve into the most, arguably, the premier sporting event in the United States?
They keep expanding and keep adding stadiums and doing more for the spectator. Any place but New York City, you expect it. It's fun to see it grow. You don't want to be too impersonal. There are ways for fans to watch some of the players warm up and things like that, which they always enjoy doing. And it's just a thrill to see the sport grow to the extent it has. And I salute the USTA for what they've done and the growth. And I know it hadn't been easy. I know they've been doing a lot of work with the inner city kids, trying to help them and get more good players. And I'm impressed with all the majors and all the improvements they've done. And they're obviously the backbone of the sport and hopefully will always be that.
And Tony, how about the evolution of the game itself over this span of 50 years? And obviously we talked about the change in surfaces and even obviously for a few years at Forest Hills, we even had it on the clay from 75 to 77. But how about the evolution of the sport, the way it's being played right now? What are your feelings about the current crop of players that, you know, who will be coming back to contend for the 2018 crown at Flushing Meadows?
They're terrific. I've never seen anybody play better than Roger Federer plays. I'm still a Rod Laver fan because, you know, he's done something in the sport that no one else has done. That's win two Grand Slams. When we played, we had to sort of, you know, we had to plan a point. You had to set it up until you got something short or something afloat that you could try to attack. Now, as soon as they can get their racket on it, they hit it as hard as they can. They're willing to make more unforced errors. And one of the major differences from the time I played and today is that there is so much more depth of talent now than when I played. When I was in my prime, if you didn't go to sleep, you couldn't lose before the quarterfinals. Now you better be ready the first Monday because there's somebody out there that can beat you if you're not ready. That makes it physically more demanding, much tougher, and that's why I think you don't see many players win a tournament now without losing a set because there are just too many good players to beat.
Now, Tony, you said you'd never seen anybody play better than Roger Federer. In your estimation, is he the best player you've ever seen, and who are some of the other ones you'd put up there, and who would you say are the players you've most enjoyed watching over these last 50 years?
You know, McEnroe was a magician with his hands. Borg was an absolute machine and cool as ice, and Sampras, great to watch in his prime, and Andre for different reasons, you know, I mean, different style of play. Federer, Nadal, I mean, look what he's done on clay. 10 French, I mean, that's unbelievable. There are so many great players, and I'm missing some that I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but it's just been fun to watch the evolution of the game, and same in the women's tennis, the Williams sisters, the way they play as hard as they hit it and as accurately, and Serena's been phenomenal, and I think they've handled themselves beautifully. That also, by the way, is what pleases me so much about Federer and Nadal in particular, what great friends and nice people they are. The spectators love them, the players love them, the officials love them. They're just great representatives for our wonderful sport of tennis.
Well, Tony, you've been one of the all-time best representatives of tennis, and we all know it, and it was a thrill for me to be able to share this time with you today on the podcast. So thanks so much for coming on with us.
Well, Steve, it's my pleasure, and thanks for thinking of me. All the best to you.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, a big thanks again to Katrina Adams of the USTA, as well as thanks to Tony Trabert for sitting down with our own Steve Flink. This has been episode 6 of Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. We are also on Audioboom. We are newly on Spotify and iHeartRadio. So we're a lot of places. You can find us anywhere. We're going to be back in a couple weeks' time. We've got another episode that I'm excited about. Thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.